Accession number 29957, Reel 6.
Mentioning this sort of trip, 29 sort of moves, here you are leaving America now. What was that section of the trip like? Presumably precautions would come into play at this point.
Yes, well, as I mentioned, I tackled the our troop commander about no duties, and he said he had no control of it, and I would was in the Americans' hands, and I did get a duty, which once again was a pleasure. I was appointed to submarine watch. I had to do, I can't remember, it might have been 2 hours on and 2 hours off or something like that, but it was quite a pleasant job, because I was on the bridge up there with the captain, and on the bridge they had the bridge stripped right across the front of the boat, and the extremities of it were actually hanging right out over the side of the ship, or it appeared that they were right over the side, and you could see ahead, you could see behind, and you could see all, you know, everywhere in between that, and the idea was to keep our eye open for submarines or whatever. But the thing was about the ship, and it was that it was that fast that they didn't have much fear of submarines, apart from the fact that they might just stumble across one that somewhere, and that just happened to be in the right spot that could boop off a shot at them. But the speed itself gave it a lot of safety. I remember I went down right down the very stern of the boat one day, and I could hardly stand up. The vibration was that bad. Probably the bearings were getting a bit worn or something, but it was really bad, and I could hardly stand up there, because the bearings on ships are made of wood. The ones on at the water's edge, you know, the ones that go under the water, but they're made of a thing called lignum vitam, a wood which wears very well, and the water actually helps it. So that's just by the way. But they might have been worn. I don't know what was causing the vibration. We didn't have any any worries there. We were pretty well looked after. We didn't get hammocks. We had cabins with bunks in them. Pretty cluttered up, but they were better than hammocks. And so we sailed blithely across the Atlantic to land in England. the place I was in my mind just a moment ago, the place that we landed at. Yes. And then...
You would land somewhere in Scotland.
Yes. Yeah. And we were taken off the boat down to the railway station, and the welcome we got there was really unbelievable. The women lined tables lined up right along the platform. Women behind them, they were serving buns and things like this, where they got them, well, they must have got an allowance for it or something, because their rationing was pretty tough. But, you know, sweet cakes and things like that, they served us with tea or coffee.
You're mentioning off-air that this would be around the end of 1943.
Yes.
There's quite a lot of, you know, obviously been going on, and some would say that the Germans were starting to get on the back foot.
Mm.
It's pretty evident that things weren't going the way of the Germans anymore.
Yeah.
And the Japanese, too, were looking less potent than they had previously.
Yes.
How are you sort of seeing that situation?
Well, look, I can't really say. I obviously I was hoping it would all be over before I got into it, but On the other hand, I didn't want it to be over before I got into it, but it was an iffy, butty kind of thing. I can't really remember any real feelings about it at all. It was all still fun, and didn't really consider what could be or what will be or what was. They put us on the train there after we had had tea or coffee and a cake, whichever we ordered, and they carried us right through from this port that we were at, that right down to Brighton. At Brighton, we had what was what they call 11 PDRC, personal something, I can't
remember. That's right.
But that's where they gathered all the Australians and all the Australian airmen, and then here they kitted them out. Made sure you got all your papers into consideration, into the correct positions, and that everything was properly recorded and that kind of thing, and then they issued you with your flying kit. After they've done all these necessary duties, well then they decided we could have a fortnight's holiday, and the promenade at Brighton Beach is actually the roof of great big halls underneath the promenade, and so they marched us down there one day and into one of these big halls, and there were about six tables with a couple of ladies sitting behind each one, and they broke us up with a queue up to each table. And this was they were welcomed here by these two ladies and asked us what we would like to do for on their 2 weeks, if we wanted to go somewhere, or did we have any relatives in England we'd like to look up, all this kind of thing. They wanted to questions you to find exactly what you wanted to do, and then you get your passes and one thing another, and you're able to go on this leave. Well, I told them I would like to go to try the English countryside. I'd like to go to a nice quiet English village, but I didn't get what I wanted at all. I got sent down to that's the name of the place. It might be Budley Salted, and I can't quite remember now. It was on the coast, but it was a big, big house, some lady's house, or gentleman's house, anyhow. It was more or less a castle, and there were lots of Australians there, and there wasn't much to do anyhow. Not that I just thought I'd try to fit into the English style, village type of thing. Go down the pub and have a few beers and get to know the locals and one thing or another, but that wasn't the case. So I quickly tired of that. I think I only stayed one night, and I took leave of the place and went back to London.
What was London like? Magnificent.
I loved London. I should have mentioned before this happened, we had a bit of time in Brighton, and they didn't know what to do with us. This was before we saw these ladies at this particular time. They didn't know what to do with us, so they used to take us for a route march around through Brighton, all the fellas marching behind the DWO, that there's the duty warrant officer, and he'd be calling the step, and starting from the back, the troops started to disappear until such time the duty warrant officer's marching along the street on his own. Everybody's taken off and gone to different places. But once again, before I get to the going away side of it too, I went to, they had dances, lovely dance all down there, and so we used to go to the dance. Well, the first night we went out, everything's a dark, but you just see a little window with open on it or something like this. And went into the first one, the hotel, that I saw him, asked for a midi and or whatever it was, a pint that they drink, and what do you want, old or new or something like that. And I said, oh, I'll try the new, and it was awful. It was flat and terrible beer. Couldn't drink it. And I said, well, give me, what do the locals drink? And they said, oh, they drink a mixture of old and new. And I said, well, give me that. I had one of them, or I got one of them, but I didn't drink it. It was atrocious. So the only drink of beer in England, they did have some very good bottle beer. So after that, it was, you always ask for Watney's or something like that. And then we drifted across to the dance hall and dancing away, and I'd pick out a girl and decided, well, I'll have a dance with her, and we'd dance around, and eventually she'd say, I just want to go and powder my nose. So away she'd go to powder her nose, and that was a word for going to the toilet. She'd go to powder her nose, and you'd stand and wait for her, and she didn't come back. This happened about three times, and I thought, bloody hell, what's wrong with me? I could dance, and anyhow, it didn't fit their idea, I suppose. And then I got onto the fourth one, and we had a dance, and I stayed with her, and I asked if she'd have another one. Yes, she would, and I came back and finished the dance and stood with her, and I said, aren't you going to powder your nose? And she said, no, I think I'm going to powder my nose too early. So I stayed with her, and I stayed with her at until the end, and I walked down before the end of the dance and before the last buses to where she had to go. We went down, sat down on the promenade in one of the shelters along there, and had a bit of a smooge. And she said, "Well, I've got to go now," because she lived out in out of Brighton. Anyhow, I just can't think of the name of the place. And she said, "The last bus goes now." And I said, "Well, I'll see you on the bus and I'll walk back." She said, "You can't do that. There's no buses back, and it's too far for you to walk." So I walked her down to the bus, I'd had a chat to her while I was with her all the time, and I found out that she had grown up down there, and her parents were down there, and that she used to come down to Brighton for the weekends, and that she had her own, she worked in London, and she had her own apartment in London. And when I decided I would leave the Budleigh Salton area thing, I'd caught the train back to London, and I rang her up and asked her if I could meet her after work, and she said yeah, and I met her after work, and we went and had a few drinks in a pub somewhere. That was the main entertainment. And she said, where are you staying tonight? And I said, well, I don't know, I've never been in London before and I don't know where to start. And she said, oh, you better come home with me. And I said, oh, it's on now. So I went home with her. She lived out in, doesn't matter, it'll come back to me. She lived out this place, and she took me out there, and she had a top-story, two-story building. She had a top-story apartment, and we climbed up the steps to her floor, and there was a small entrance there, or a veranda, I suppose you'd call it. It wasn't very wide because it had a sleep-out built onto one side of it. And as I walked past this thing, there was a bed in this little sleep-out, and she said, that's where you'll sleep. And I said, oh, you're not thinking, are you? She said, yeah, that's where you're going to sleep. All right. So anyhow, we stopped, and we went inside, and we stopped. She lit the electric fire, and we got down on the rug and she made a coffee, and we got down on the rug and in front of the fire and just talking about drinking the coffee and having the biscuit and talking about things in general. And then she said, it came up dares, and she said, oh, never dare me to do anything or I'll do it. Well, I said, well, I'll dare you to sleep with me. Oh, well, let me sleep with you. And she said, oh, you devil. So anyway, I did get into a bed, but there's no way I could touch her all night long. And she just, that was it, no touching. So I didn't get much sleep. But I saw a lot of this girl. She, I was always going back to London. It was never no touchy, not always no touchy. I went back to London to see her for the whole 2 years I was there, though. All the leaves I got, I went back to London, and I got to know London as well as I knew Perth.
All right, well, let's talk about that in relation to, he's a young bloke, seeing a bit of the world now, he's, you know, sort of in a place like London, getting to see the nightlife, getting to know, you know, special young ladies, all that sort of thing. And I wanted you to describe to us, if you could, at that time, what was your impression of London on a war footing?
War was still going on. I mean, while I was there, I experienced, I was in London the first night the flying bombs came over. I was in London when the V2s started to come over.
Well, what was London like with that going on around you? And,
well,
and that, the sort of general impression of the spirit that you could see in the locals.
The spirit was that they weren't going to be beaten in air. It didn't matter what they threw over. Those things started while I was there, but the first time I went into London, or that we got leave to go to London, with a friend of mine, we got a billet with some people at a place called a suburb called Eastcote or something like that. This fellow worked in the food industry, I don't know, somewhere in a warehouse or something like that, and his wife, so they always had plenty of food, and they had a great big collie dog. And I experienced there, not the first air raid, but the first one was while I was at Brighton. Earlier on, I'm still at Brighton at this stage, I think, yes. Oh no, we got a... this friend of mine, we volunteered to work in our head office in... that's the RAAF... the Royal Australian Air Force headquarters in London. We went there to work as clerks. Now that got us to stay at London. We got a billet with these both of us. We got a billet with these people at Eastcote, well fed. But while I was there, that's where I experienced my first air raid in London, and it was on. It was pretty thick.
All right. Well, let's talk about what that was like. I mean, here you are. This is war.
Yes.
This is what war is in civilian situation.
Yeah.
What were your thoughts at this time?
Well, it was pretty frightening. I went outside to have a look, and the people said, don't get out there, and you could actually hear the shrapnel from the anti-aircraft tumbling down around you. It was scary, and you couldn't look out there. I stayed on the veranda, of course. But when I went back inside, the host and hostess and this bloody great collie dog all under the table. But get down under there, anything's like that. And so my mate got down on one side, and I had to fight the collie dog to get in the other side. And that's the way we spent the rest of the attack. And it was very scary indeed. You just keep your fingers crossed that it's not gonna happen to you. That's about all you could do. And I did experience one or two of those where in London and about London you'd have to get in and under a doorway or find somewhere to get under something so that you're not going to get hit and hit in the head with a bit of shrapnel, let alone a bomb. And they were scary. When you heard the siren go, your stomach just, your heart sinks down into your stomach. It's a very, very queer feeling.
Well, this is the sort of thing, presumably, that you would be involved in creating on the other side.
Oh, yes.
At some time. Did you ever think of that?
Only more so. Not that time I didn't. No, at that time I didn't. I hadn't got to that stage. I didn't know whether I was going to go under bombers or fighters or what.
What was your hope?
Well, I would... My hope was that perhaps I'd be able to fly a mosquito, which it was used as a bomber, and but not didn't carry big loads. I wasn't particularly keen to go to bomber command because I knew of their casualty rates, and they were pretty high at that time. Luckily, they eased off as the war went on, and. As we begin to take control of the situation, it eased off, and I don't pretend to be anything other than lucky to go through at that time when the casualties were not nowhere near as high. I mean, I had a number of people killed, people that I knew personally killed in Bomber Command. Bomber Command was not just... flying over Germany. I mean, it started long before that. When you started your flying training in England, which we did more training in England than we did in Australia, but in England we were treated as trained pilots, and we had to learn to fly the different aircraft, and we also had to learn the actual procedures that were set in place for all kinds of things, for if you got lost over England, how to find your way home and the correct way to approach the people who can help you find your way home, how to address people, how to use the RT, the different safety or locating outfits like pundits and flashing lights here, there and everywhere. It was very interesting. That was the first part of it. That was what they called it, the advanced flying unit, which was done with airspeed Oxfords, very small, just akin to the old Anson that we flew, a little bit faster and that, and a little bit more dangerous, or a lot more dangerous. And then we progressed from there. We went on to Wellington Aircraft, which was the first really heavy aeroplane we came in contact with. So once we went on to the Wellingtons, then we knew we were destined for Bomber Command. But now, once we got onto the Wellington, we knew that we were set for Bomber Command. But this didn't actually mean that we'd be flying in Lancasters, because there were Halifaxes.
You mentioned Wellingtons.
They were Wellingtons, but these were the ones that were being used in Bomber Command. But we actually went on to Wellingtons as a part of the training for heavy aircraft. They were still using Wellingtons in operations, and they used them a lot in the Middle East. But I didn't like the Wellington at all, because I was used to flying an aeroplane like it should be flown, and landing them. I had very good judgment. My appreciation of how far I was off the ground when I was landing. I don't think I ever bounced an aeroplane in, any aeroplane in at all, except the Wellington, because the Wellington aeroplane was a set up different to an ordinary plane, it had an automatic trim. I mean, to trim an aircraft, it's a wheel that you turn around to actually trim it so that it flies the way you want it to fly. So as you come into land, you use this trimming wheel to change the attitude of the aircraft, because the slower you go, the more the tail sinks down, and you're getting more of a airflow over the wings, because they're slightly pointing upwards, and you gradually let yourself down. And I could do it. I take pride in the fact that my judgment in this direction was as good as anybody's, and I never bounced an aeroplane except to Wellington.